You're listening to Coach Your Brains Out by Gold Medal Squared. This is part two of our conversation with Harjeev Singh. This time we shifted the discussion on motor learning to talk about using constraints in practice.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
All right, we'll move on to the constraints-led approach, which is something I've been getting into, trying to understand and study up a little bit more, and I've been already asking you questions about it. But could you just give us a basic understanding of what the constraint-led approach is and how to apply it?
Yeah, so the constraints-led approach, or CLA, without getting into sort of the theoretical underpinning, is actually something, quite frankly, I've seen volleyball coaches use it, especially at like the collegiate and national team levels, and they do it effectively. I just don't think they know what the name of it is, like, for example, the CLA. So essentially, the constraints model is about understanding movements as an interaction between the individual, the task, and the environment. And so I know the word constraint has a negative connotation to it, but it's sort of like just like a boundary, which encourages certain behaviors. I think that's a good way to put it. And I think a good thought here is, you know, how come the most elite indoor volleyball players aren't automatically really good beach players? You know, it obviously takes some time to get to that level, but there's changes in a lot of things, right? And although the idea of, you know, three touches and hitting a ball over a net is there, you're still working with less than a number of players. You're still working with, you know, the sand and the outdoors. I mean, there's so many different things. So that drastically changes behavior. To break it down a little bit, actually, I was just writing a blog on this, applying the model to volleyball. Individual constraints would be like just physical characteristics, motivation, attention. And you'll see, you know, this all kind of relates to optimal theory and then all that. For example, environmental constraints would be temperature, sound, sand, you know, fans, whatever, you know, whatever it may be there. And then a task, right? The goal, the task, the rules, the space, the instruction, the time. I mean, there's a lot to consider. And so, like I said, I think coaches, especially in volleyball, they do it, right? We do drills that are have certain conditions to them, right? Where maybe just isolating that you can only hit from the outside, or we're 22-22, or, you know, stuff like that. So we kind of do it already. And this is just sort of a good framework that coaches can use to plan practices and stuff like that.
And what are the benefits of the CLA?
Yeah, so a lot of the literature from the CLA has shown that just using constraints, this approach, can increase performance in sports like, you know, baseball, for example. It can encourage creativity, decision-making, this idea of adaptability. And again, I think constraints-led approach is really grasping this idea of variability and allowing sort of implicit learning to flourish through this idea of, you know, let the players sort of explore and kind of, you know, explore their own sort of behaviors and get to whatever sort of goal that they need to get to. It's no longer sort of a coach-centered approach, but a performer-centered one. And so I think that's a good distinction of it. But yeah, the benefits of the CLA, from what I've read, have been pretty positive. I think the only problem is we have to know how to implement it the right way. You have to really know the certain behaviors that players are in. You have to really study sort of the representative, the representation of the sport at certain situations, at certain times, and then replicate that. So I think it's really important that the model is there, but we really have to know how to sort of incorporate it and use it.
You mentioned implicit learning. Can you explain what that is and how a constraint-led approach brings out implicit learning?
Yeah, so the constraint-led approach is really... like I said, it's a performer-centered approach. So what happens is you're kind of setting the stage for the athlete to, you know, go ahead and you know, use these, you know, use their current level of motivation, use their sort of the task, whatever the task goal may be, and kind of allow them to sort of, we use the word self-organize a lot, allow them to kind of, you know, show what they're doing rather than telling them what they have to do and what you need to see. And so I think it really just goes down to that. You're not prescribing things, for example. So I think that's a critical distinction between implicit versus more the explicit literature that's out there.
Okay, so what are some constraints that are kind of no-brainers for coaches that they should be using every day in practice for both beach and indoor?
Yeah, so this was a fun question. I think the first is definitely use the court, use the net or some version of it. I know, for example, with COVID and you can't really access gyms at this point, you know, using a wall when you're serving, but, you know, the height is the height of the net. So like stuff like that. It makes no sense sometimes when I think about it for me to do hitting lines when there's no like serve or ball coming over the net. I think that's critical to use. So stuff like that. And there's a lot to consider. I think people oftentimes harp on, you know, using a box or not, for example. And so I think you have to really be, first of all, be purposeful for what you're doing. You have to really know what the end goal of that drill or whatever it may be is. And then again, it's all affected by practice conditions, right? Are you kind of working on maybe a technique? So maybe you kind of have to go or want to go more, you know, blocked practice, or, you know, you want to go more game-like, like what are you trying to do? And so I think those are really important considerations to use. But yeah, I think I would definitely say, you know, use the net, use the court. That would be the first two things that you need to do.
And what are some ways that constraints might be used the wrong way? Not optimal. Like a coach could maybe be using constraints, but it's not for an effective drill or limits it somehow.
Yeah, that's again. You want to know, you know, what the goal is and what you're doing. Constraints. Yeah, you're right. I mean, the model itself is there, and you have to really use it effectively in terms of what you're trying to get at. If you use it sort of in a way that, you know, limits their levels of motivation, right? I think that's crucial. If you set up a drill, for example, and they just end up, I guess, not scoring what you want them to score or what the goal of the drill is, you know, the levels of motivations will go down, and that's going to affect their sort of individual constraint, and that's going to then affect the task at hand, and then eventually sort of the environmental constraints and whatnot. So I think there's you have really have to play with it. I think the resource is there, but again, you have to really know your player and what, you know, what they are good at versus what, you know, makes them struggle a little bit.
So something you had suggested to me was to pass with a lower net for, so we've been trying it out, and I'm kind of curious, I guess, for Billy, what it's been like. We've been doing some warm-ups where we lower the net like by a foot and are just trying to bomb serves at you. So have you seen any benefits, Billy?
Yeah, it feels like when you exaggerate the situation, you kind of get used to that speed. And then when you bring it down to, I guess, the normal level, you're kind of already ready to get your platform out super fast, or, you know, to defend in that way. So I think it just, yeah, anytime you can kind of exaggerate what your focus is, it really, you know, hits home, where sometimes I might make a more subtle change if it's just, you know, the status quo.
You know, another thing I was thinking about was, this could be beach or indoor. If, you know, just telling your passers to pass low, without really telling your setter that they're going to pass low. I know beach is a little bit different, but if you're doing a drill where just one person is receiving the ball and the other person is setting, you know, you're telling them, you know, to set the ball or to pass the ball lower, rather than, you know, changing the height of the net, it's going to force your other player to use a bump set, which if that's the goal, then that's going to definitely be beneficial. So stuff like that, I think, is important to consider.
What do you think about something, you know, say at Billy's level of raising the net, so hitters have to, I don't know, reach higher and hit from a higher point? Is there benefit to that?
Yeah, I mean, I've seen that done as well. Like I said, you're still on the court, you know, you're still using the net. I think there's benefits to that, not only sort of skill wise, but obviously it's a higher net. A little more power that needs to go into, you know, your jump and whatnot. So there's obviously more physiological and neuromuscular sort of benefits there. But yeah, like I said, you're still using what you're going to be using on game day. So I think that's really important to consider.
And then the other one we did, we were having Billy stand in different spots. Like I'd always thought, you know, specificity, the passer's got to start, you know, the same spot they do in a match, because that's where they're going to, I don't know, that's how long the serve will take to get to them. So they have to get all those reps. But you suggested having them, you know, move his starting point up closer to the net or deeper. And I could start to see the benefits. Like it forced him to read and he had to make new moves with his platform that, you know, we'd kind of have to like artificially create.
Yeah.
Without the constraint. But one other thing you had mentioned is changing the target too. So like maybe try to pass, like have him pass to different spots. Why would you want to do that?
I think that was for the setter. Just for the setter to get to the ball and create like an, I guess if it's out of system, for example, to create a set that's hittable. I think that would be why. Or also, I mean, if you're serve receiving, being able to hit the ball from different sort of different areas of the court and still get it into certain areas on the other side of the court, I think is also beneficial. Because I think what happens is we kind of just go into this sort of notion that the ball has to go to the middle of the court, which granted, I mean, it's effective, but it doesn't necessarily happen in the game all the time. And sand volleyball, obviously, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on in terms of the wind and all that. So, you know, how can we in practice be very much more chaotic to then allow this to be, I guess, more, I think a good sort of concept is like this whole differential learning concept, which is every repetition is totally different. And this kind of like allows you to build that repertoire for, you know, for competition. So.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So another one that we've been doing is, you have to hit whatever first ball, you have to hit it as hard as you can. So you can see the benefits of, you know, you have to have a slow to fast approach. You have to have a good relationship between yourself and the setter. So there's all these benefits. But my one concern was, does it limit autonomy if I'm forcing him to do a certain thing?
I don't think so. I think this is one of the sort of, I think, limitations in the constraints that approach, but it's definitely getting some interest now, especially in the UK and Australia. As mentioned, you know, the constraints that approach has sort of instructional constraints as well. So, you know, you can, I think when you talk about hitting the ball as hard as you can, that's definitely, you know, if you're trying to get them to actually hit the ball as hard as they can, that's fine. I think that would work. But then you also have these added sort of components of, you know, you can, let's say, these instructional constraints using effective questioning and all that, you know, giving them sort of this choice on task order. You can still like apply, again, if we refer back to like autonomy sort of language, you can apply all of this in this one very condition. I don't think you're going to limit autonomy. There's just so many ways to promote autonomy that you can still do so, which is important. And then obviously you can set other constraints like the number of players on the other side, the size of the court, different challenges that you have for your player. And so all of that kind of works. And so there's that sort of coach-athlete relationship that needs to be honed in here. So I wouldn't say that, you know, the CLA will limit autonomy. In fact, I think if CLA used sort of appropriately, will enhance autonomy and will allow autonomy to survive, to thrive. And this is where I do think that We need to start incorporating more of the optimal theory stuff into more of the CLA stuff and vice versa. Right now, I feel like there are two different sort of camps and we're not kind of, you know, relating them. At the end of the day, they're all about motor learning and skill acquisition. So hopefully I think this is where the research will go. But yeah.
We have a couple of listener questions for you, if you're ready for that. This first one's from Joe Trinzi, and he asks, how does autonomy support interact with flow? He says, sometimes direct commands seem to enhance flow. For example, I'm thinking of a beach player going up, hearing their partner call nobody, and ripping it right down the middle of the court. You're in the flow state, and that simple directive seems to enhance it. So I guess, how does autonomy interact with that flow state, as he describes it?
Well, I think flow state is also just a big component is confidence. And so autonomy is all about building confidence. So I think I think they're related. I don't think they're separate. And again, you know, as you're practicing, for example, you know, this idea of, hey, when there's nobody on the net, I'm going to blast that ball. And like just practicing that way will obviously translate to game time when there's you call nobody, you know that, oh, that's my cue of blasting the ball away. But if in practice, for example, if we don't do that and, you know, we say nobody and then we kind of just, you know, sort of tip the ball or dink the ball over, that's going to also translate. So I think they're both sort of both about confidence, and it really comes down to how you practice and stuff like that. And beach is a little bit different, right? Because it's only a two-player game, so you really have to trust each other and all that. And that also builds self-efficacy, which also builds autonomy. I think what happens is we kind of just think about autonomy as choice or as you know, different ways to promote it. There's also, you know, autonomy is also intrinsic in nature, I think I would say. Just your level of confidence in your own ability will affect it. So I think it's a long-winded answer of saying that flow and autonomy are pretty much on the same level.
You mentioned self-efficacy a couple times. Can you explain what that is and I guess how it's different than self-esteem?
So self-efficacy really just kind of refers to sort of my own belief in my capacity to execute something. I think self-esteem is, you know, what is sort of like the social, I think the social sort of, I don't know, a good way to put it, I guess the social culture sort of around me that will affect my, so I actually just gave a lecture on this yesterday to my class and on self-esteem. And, you know, as you're going up, for example, and, you know, your group of friends will drastically affect your self-esteem levels. And if you're going to say, you know, participate in more physical activities or not. And so self-esteem, I think, is related in a way to self-efficacy because you need to have this notion of, you know, I'm able to do it, and then this belief that, you know, I can do it. So I think they're related in nature for sure. But we talk about self-efficacy only. We talk about just, you know, my capacity and my belief in executing a certain behavior that's sort of necessary to achieve sort of optimal performance or whatever it may be. Self-esteem is a little, I think you need it. You definitely need it. But I think... yeah, I think they're different in terms of what they're trying to get at.
And is enhancing expectations one of the most effective ways to build self-efficacy?
Yeah, I think, again, the interrelatedness of autonomy, enhanced expectancies, and external focus is all about, you know, promoting self-efficacy in yourself. You want to feel in control. You want to feel like... you want to feel like you're in control of the situation, that you're worth something, that you're a human being at the end of the day. So there's, I guess, all in all, I think the whole point here is, yes, you want to build this this self-efficacy.
Joe has one more. As coaches, we want to work to build autonomy support for our players, but are there situations where autonomy support is inappropriate and could cause players to overthink?
I think, yeah, it depends on how you were to promote autonomy. So if I, you know, if it's like 24, 23, and it's, you know, it's a game winning sort of a match winning set and the game is on the line and the player comes to you in a timeout and you say, try hitting, zone five, try hitting the seam between zone five or six. Or go ahead and serve any way you want. I don't know if that's going to be sort of beneficial versus telling them, hey, you've been here before. I trust you. I know you can do it and go out there and hit the ball away. Like there's certain ways that you can sort of induce it. I think if you induce autonomy wrong or not wrong, but in an inappropriate manner, it will definitely have negative effects. It's not an end all be all. It really depends on how and what type of ways you promote it, which again goes back to your own creativity as a coach and the interaction that you have with your players. And I would also assume that it's going to be it'd be different if you were to go from a more novice to a more expert level player. So,
all right, we got another listener. He's a fellow autonomy and motor learning lover, Andy Bass. He asks, if you only had time to explain three motor learning concepts to a volleyball coach, what would they be and why?
Yeah, so there would be external focus, autonomy support, and enhanced expectancies. just because I think they're all related. I think, with this sort of new approach to motor learning, like I said, it's going to affect the constraints-led approach, which is another sort of model of skill acquisition. It's going to affect block versus random practice. It's going to affect all. So I think this is the three pillars that we need to really start focusing on, because it's going to affect how we go ahead and design our practices, how we go ahead and give feedback and whatever it may be. So I do think that these three pillars are something that, again, the theory came out in 2016, so it's fairly new. And I think I just saw. It's only been cited like 300 times. So there's definitely room for improvement. I think that's where we're going with it. But as mentioned, all these different sort of models that we see out there, there's always a relation to one of these three pillars. I just saw a paper on, feedback and when to do it and how to do it. And they built this really, really intricate sort of graph, and half of it was all about, external focus. Half of it was about motivation, and all that is what we're talking about. So I think this is the sort of the three things that we need to look at. And I obviously, I might be biased here, but I really do think that this is where it's going. And I had the privilege to study with Dr. Richard McGill during my master's degree. And Dr. Richard McGill was all about his research was all about contextual interference. And so that was obviously different than what we're at here. But like I said, these three pillars will affect, that as well. So, I think that a long answer to say, I think these are the three main ones.
Well, I think Dr. Wolf is smiling when she hears you answer that one. So that seems like the right answer, especially if you want to finish up your PhD under her. You better answer that way.
Yeah.
Andy has another one. He says, in your daily life, whether it's working out, playing volleyball, doing another sport, do you use differential learning or constraints-led approach when engaged in activity? What do you do?
Yeah, that's a good one. So I am, I'm still trying to really understand the theoretical underpinnings between both. I think before I go into really applying these models, I really want to understand where and how they come from. And there's like a really, really rich theoretical sort of background into both of these. I tend to do a lot more differential learning because I really like variability. I'll do different set. Like for example, if you're working out, I wouldn't necessarily do three sets of 10, a back squat. I change it up like every you know, every two reps, I do two back squats, go into maybe two sort of pause squats or whatever it may be. So I kind of just change it here and there. And I've always been interested in variability. So I think that that kind of goes along that route. But they are also, I think, very much interrelated in terms of what their theoretical underpinnings are. So, you know, I would say that I'm a little bit of both, but I more so tend to go on the differential learning route. At the end of the day, they both improve performance. They both improve creativity. And they're actually, both of them are pretty much rooted in the similar sort of similar theoretical stuff. So I think, they go hand in hand.
I had a quick follow up on differential learning, and I probably don't quite understand it correctly, but I've been, you know, I think it's just, I see it kind of like random and varied practice. So I'll have the servers move every time in practice. Like, you can't serve from the same spot twice. And they were asking, you know, then I was explaining, I think there's a lot of benefits from a skill acquisition side. They're asking, oh, what if in a match, like, I find, you know, serving from this spot is working? Do you think there's a difference in like a practice skill acquisition versus like, you know, tactics and trying to score points?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a good question. I think the goal of differential learning is kind of like, if I were to put it in layman's terms, it's kind of, you're building up this sort of reference in your sort of, I guess, mind and body. The underpinning is all about, like, you know, noise and stuff like that. I think you bring up a good question. I don't think the whole point of practice and using differential learning is so that the players are comfortable in terms of adapting to these different, these different sort of distances or where they want to go on the court. And it's just going to help when you translate to a game setting, when they pick a spot. And because, I mean, at the end of the day, if you practice like a game, they should know what spot they're more comfortable in. And then obviously in terms of tactics, yeah, that's something that's a question that I've had as well, because, you know, I would, a player may be comfortable, really comfortable serving from the right side, but tactic wise, you know, you may want to serve from the left side. So are they comfortable doing that or not? That's something that you would have to kind of do in practice to assure that, because the last thing you want to do is the player goes to the right side and then you tell them to move to the left, and then they mess up. And so I think, and like I said, I'm still trying to understand what these two frameworks really mean. At the end of the day, you know, that's what I'll.
Cool. And Andy has one more. What about the current sport landscape is allowing motor learning concepts to be more widely accepted by coaches? And why do you think this may be, since the field has been around for over a century?
Yeah, that's a good question. I just think the research is getting out there more. Coaches are really trying to understand this stuff. There's a lot of, I think the best way to put it is that the coaches are taking the time out now to actually understand this stuff, which is awesome for us. The landscape, people want to know how to better their athletes, especially with the climate that we are in, where, you know, at the end of the day, winning matters, to keep your job, all this stuff. So this, and there's more funding now for more educational opportunities. There's more courses out there that are readily available, conferences that are really just looking at, you know, just motor learning in general. There's a big push, you know, in Australia and in the UK on, you know, really understanding skill acquisition as a whole. And I think it's really, really just kind of allowed coaches to start understanding this stuff. And I think social media is huge for this. And so, yeah, I just think this is like a whole bunch of things that are just allowing coaches to take interest in all this. At the end of the day, we want our athletes to get better, and we want to keep our jobs. And I think that's the and we'll do anything and everything we can in order to do that.
Yeah, and we want to win. So I think that also is motivating. Exactly. All right, last question. It's from Dr. Gabrielle Wolf. She asks, I'm wondering what his recommendations might be for coaching younger or novice players versus more experienced players. Should their attention be directed differently? Does he have some examples for specific coaching instructions?
Yeah. So, like I mentioned, I think that goes down, goes back to the sort of distance of attentional focus stuff. When you're a novice, you want to maybe focus, you're focusing more on techniques. So you want to maybe perhaps, elicit an external focus that's more closer to your body versus an expert farther away. So I'm actually just writing up a couple of projects right now. We compared sort of novices and experts, volleyball players, and, we found that, novices do better in terms of their passing accuracy when we tell them to concentrate on the platform versus experts do better when they concentrate on the target that's in front of them. That was pretty important. And now I'm starting to, like I said, an external focus can also be elicited by imagery or metaphors and analogies. Then I started thinking, a platform is really just another word for the space between your wrists and elbows. How does that affect performance, especially with the novice athletes? So now we're trying to get into that and see, what's going on over there. And then that's just going to hopefully end up going into like different sort of volleyball skills. And we'll kind of build a framework and a good sort of amount of resource for understanding this stuff, especially with the major skills of our game. I think that's the whole point with attentional focus and level of expertise. To understand how and why this happens, that's sort of what we're getting into now. I'm really curious to know what happens in the brain. At the same time, biomechanically, what's going on? Are we showing more sort of interlimb coordination in the sort of joints that are like the shoulder joint versus the wrist and elbow? How does that change as we go on in terms of expertise level and in a skill such as serving? So we're interested to see that now, and I think that would be sort of a good answer to her question, hopefully.
Nice. Yeah, we'll see what she says. I'm gonna make sure we send it to her. Well, this was fun, Harjeev. We really appreciate and like I said, we're just so lucky to have someone who's a volleyball player, someone who loves volleyball, studying the stuff and who understands and is able to explain it to us. And yeah, I'm thankful that I, got to ask you questions today, and you continue to answer my crazy emails I send you. And I hope we can continue to learn from you.
No, absolutely, man. I love the questions you send. They're actually, make me think a lot, which is good. Pleasure to be on, man. I'm excited, and I'm glad that we can connect. We finally connected, and so
we did it.
Yeah.